I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 30 years ago, someone in the Ford White House scribbled out a memo and sent it to Dick Cheney. Cheney was then Deputy Chief of Staff. It was not a matter of national security. The memo told Cheney that, quote, "We will be unable in the short term to fix the drainage problem in the sink in the first floor bathroom." The reporter and writer James Mann reprints this memo in his new book, not to poke fun at Cheney, but rather to illustrate how his time and experience in Washington has helped make him, as Mann puts it, perhaps the most powerful vice president in American history. Mann's book takes us a lot further. He includes Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, Paul Wolfowitz, and Condoleezza Rice in his description of the Vulcans. It's a name that President Bush's foreign policy team gave itself. Vulcan was the Roman god of fire. He was also known as the weapon maker, the god who mastered the heat of volcanoes to forge the trident of Poseidon and the armor of Achilles. Well, today's modern-day Vulcans are known for their unquestioning faith in the power of the U.S. military and their resolve to spread American ideals through word and force. We invite you to join our discussion this hour. What is the Vulcan plan for America? Where do those ideas come from? What are the consequences? And when it comes to foreign policy, well, who's really in charge in Washington? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is the writer, James Mann. His new book is called Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. James, it's good of you to join us.
Glad to be with you.
A book about the foreign policy of the George Bush presidency, but George Bush himself is not a part of this book. Why that decision on your part?
Well, for a couple reasons. First and foremost, this is a book about how American policy has developed, how it's changed, in some senses, little pieces of continuity over the last 30 years. I wanted to look at the roots of this administration's foreign policy by comparing what the people who are in it have done to their actions and their statements and their beliefs in the past, to really trace a 30-year history. And to do that, you need people with a record in prior administrations. In that sense, ironically, George W. Bush is not a Vulcan. The definition of a Vulcan is someone who served in one or more of these previous Republican administrations and then came back into office in 2001.
He had no past, I think are the words that you use to describe the president. You make the point, and it's a fascinating one, that this gang really doesn't share common roots in academe or in business. But in fact, if you look for what they have in common, it's roots in the Pentagon. It's roots in the defense establishment.
That's right. I compare them to two other famous generations of American foreign policymakers. One is the famous, the best and the brightest, the Kennedy generation that brought America into its war with Vietnam. And the other is the group commonly called the wise men of the late 40s, people like Dean Acheson and George Kennan. And in the case of the best and the brightest, you know, one of the common links in their past is academia, Harvard. Mm-hmm. In the case of the wise men, most of them came through law firms, investment banks. Uniquely with this group, you have an American foreign policy that's made by people who one way or another came through the Pentagon. That's true not just we have an administration which we have two former secretaries of defense, Rumsfeld and Cheney. We have a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell. Both the deputy secretaries of state and defense, Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Armitage, spent a lot of time in the Pentagon. People don't realize it, but even Condoleezza Rice's first job for a year was a first work in Washington was in the Pentagon for a year. So there's a remarkable amount of Pentagon experience with this group and not as much diplomatic or State Department experience.
Did it surprise you, James? I mean, I know this is a beat that you're very familiar with, but when you started to follow those different colored balls of wool back through the corridors of power in various administrations, were you surprised by how far back they went and how often these people had collided in previous administrations?
I was. I mean, I started with the idea that, gee, I recognized that these people had a long history, longer than other people realized, because my first two books were about China, and in writing about China, the two of the main policymakers for the Republicans were Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Armitage in the 80s and early 90s. And I knew they had a long history. But when I began to look, trace back to really research this book, I was just floored at the interconnections. I had no idea really just how far back and the long history, for example, of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, who really worked for him for several years, almost as his top administrative aide, his doorkeeper in the Nixon White House, and then for a while in the Ford administration.
I got quite caught up in a moment you describe when Rumsfeld and Cheney, who have their place in the Nixon administration, then are a part of the changeover to the Ford administration. And the power that Henry Kissinger has at that time is in many ways instructive in teaching us about the way that power is exercised today, isn't it?
Absolutely. Kissinger really was at the peak of his power in the last couple of years of the Nixon administration and then the first year of the Ford administration. And indeed, it's a story that Dick Cheney has sometimes told. When Nixon resigned, President Ford asked Don Rumsfeld to come back from NATO to begin to think about how to put together a new administration for him. Rumsfeld, in turn, called Cheney, asked him to meet him at Dulles Airport. And starting then, right in August of 1974, they began working on what the Ford administration's policy should be. And what Cheney said, his reminiscence, his recollection, this is from an interview in the mid-90s, is that Ford's instructions were work out domestic policy, work out the budget and so on, keep your hands off foreign policy. That's really completely Henry Kissinger's preserve. And that's the way the Ford administration ran for a year or so. And then you get into 1975, a year or so later, and Rumsfeld, who's the White House chief of staff by then, begins to whittle away at Kissinger, at Kissinger's authority, Kissinger's power. This isn't strictly an initiative from Rumsfeld. You have people all across the political map, inside the administration and out, saying Kissinger has too much power.
But in political science terms, what they were also whittling away at was the Kissinger realpolitik approach to world affairs, the embracing of détente. That's what they were really working against, and that's quite consistent with those men as we know them today, isn't it?
Absolutely. Eventually, as Cheney and Rumsfeld grew in authority within the Ford administration, they began to challenge Kissinger not only personally, but for his views, for his support of détente, for his realpolitik. And there was a third person, junior then, within the ranks, Paul Wolfowitz, who was working at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. And he really began to challenge Kissinger's entire worldview. He really challenged the entire notion of balance of power politics. So you have Wolfowitz challenging theoretically. He was then very young. You have Rumsfeld, first as White House Chief of Staff and then as Secretary of Defense, challenging his policies. And in a very much subtler way, you have Dick Cheney, White House Chief of Staff, cutting away at Kissinger's authority. There's a famous and extremely important incident at the 1976 Republican convention when Ronald Reagan, who's challenging Ford, pushes for what's called a morality and foreign policy plank. It's a direct attack on Kissinger's policies. And it was Cheney, who's working for Ford, who persuades Ford not to fight this, that it would be a battle they couldn't win that might damage Ford politically. And he was probably right politically. Politically, that was the right thing to do. But I also think that he tended to sympathize with the Reagan critique.
But that wasn't something that was, at that time, owned by Republican neoconservatives. That came as powerfully from the Democratic side, Scoop Jackson, at that time, right?
You're exactly right. In fact, there were no Republican neoconservatives at that time. The neoconservatives really were a group of Democrats who were unhappy with the foreign policies of President Carter and the Democrats in Congress. They felt they were too liberal.
So James, if we talk about what Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld were trying to change in the mid-70s and from that moment on, back then, did they have a way of defining their worldview? Was it what we see today, or was it still sort of being crystallized?
Yeah, I think it was not. It was not yet crystallized. It was crystallized in the sense that they wanted to challenge the Soviet Union more forcefully than either the Liberal Democrats or the Kissinger wing of the Republican Party. So they were hawkish on the Soviet Union. That's a little bit short of a full worldview.
And we should bring Richard Armitage and Colin Powell into this mix because they, of course, are key players in the Vulcans. But those two come to this very small table from different roots.
Very different. They both come from the military. They were both in Vietnam, though in different ways. Powell was a regular Army officer who served two tours in Vietnam. Richard Armitage was something else. His Vietnam tour was something of an epic. He started out, he's a graduate of the Naval Academy and started out on a destroyer off the coast of Vietnam and then kept volunteering for Vietnam duty, fought with what is officially described as ambush teams. And while Armitage denies it, I talked to one friend who said that he was in the famous Phoenix program. One way or another, he re-upped in Vietnam. He volunteered two or three times. He was the one guy, he was so strongly opposed to an American pullout from Vietnam that in 1973, after the American forces pulled out or were withdrawn, he said America was behaving like a runaway dad. He stayed on in Vietnam for a couple more years, and then finally, in the final days of Vietnam, he helped in the final American evacuation effort and led a flotilla of boats from Vietnam to the Philippines with tens of thousands of South Vietnamese refugees. He had this strong identification with Vietnam. So just to step back, Powell and Armitage had formative experiences in Vietnam and drew lessons from that about the need to change American military power.
They still sort of fancy themselves as the outsiders, as the country mice in a city town, though, right?
That's exactly right, yes.
The Vulcans, the rise of the Vulcans, the history of Bush's war cabinet. My guest this hour, James Mann. It's a brand new book. We're talking about the links and the connections and the collisions between these people before they all found themselves formulating the Bush foreign policy that we see today. We invite your calls. We invite you to join this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Who is actually making the decisions in Washington today? How much of what's being decided now really does have connections back to Nixon's time, Reagan's time? I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, James Mann, author of Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet, points to a moment at the Republican Convention in 1976 when Ronald Reagan talked about morality in foreign policy. And on this week when the Bush administration is, in a way, marking the anniversary of the war with Iraq, we're hearing elements of that in comments from the people who are part of Bush's war cabinet, in particular on CBS's Face the Nation just this past Sunday. The idea of morality in foreign policy is something that we heard from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
You know, throughout history, there have been people who've argued that don't get involved. In a neighborhood, we see it. We see someone beating up on the neighborhood children, and you have a choice. You can either help the neighborhood children against the bully or not. And people, there have always been people in countries in the world that have said, gee, don't do that. It's kind of like feeding an alligator, hoping it eats you last.
Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, joining me on the program this hour. James Mann, author of Rise of the Vulcans. I suspect, are hearing these people in a way illustrate the case that you make for where they stand today as they all take part in this sort of one-week anniversary of speaking out, James.
Well, yeah, but when I hear that from Rumsfeld, I think, again, of the importance of history, because if you trace the history for these people, you find that their views change, their actions change over time, and that they're not consistent. So when Rumsfeld talks about the importance of not avoiding dealing with Saddam Hussein's abuses, I take that as what he meant there. I say, sure, but, you know, do people realize that in the 1980s, the United States was strongly supporting Saddam Hussein, even as he was using chemical weapons, and that Rumsfeld in particular, this is not on his own, but as an emissary and special ambassador, special envoy for Ronald Reagan, made one of the key visits, in fact, the highest level American visit in many years to Baghdad to talk to Saddam Hussein. So the question is, he's saying that now. What was he saying back then?
There's actually another point in the mid-'80s during the Reagan administration where you put your pen on a moment in American foreign policy, which I found is revealing. And that's when, I guess, 85, late 85, 86, when the U.S. is trying to figure out its relations with the Philippines, comes in the wake of an election that Ferdinand Marcos tried to manipulate. And there's an argument in the White House. Do we stick with this guy because he's our guy, or do we not? And that's where Paul Wolfowitz begins to start to turn this page. Is that an accurate way of looking at it, James?
Yes, it is. And that was a very, very important episode, and Wolfowitz has been consistent on the importance of democracy since that time. Relatively speaking, no one's completely consistent. But within the Reagan administration, you have the president himself saying, we got to support Marcos. It's either our guys or the communists, which wasn't true at all. And then you get a different school of thought arising. Mostly, it was led by Secretary of State George Shultz and some of the people under him, including Wolfowitz, which was that American interests are best served by pushing democratic government in the Philippines. It was really groundbreaking. Reagan resisted quite intensely right up till the end. But after Marcos left and Cory Aquino became president of the Philippines, this group of people began to broaden their viewpoint and so pushed for democracy in South Korea the following year. And it became a consistent strand of thinking and I would say neoconservative doctrine. Now, people are never consistent. I won't say people are never, but people are rarely consistent throughout their careers. And in fact, although they never admit it, the neoconservatives were really doing an about-face when they talk about the importance of democracy in the Third World during the Carter years when the neoconservatives are complaining that President Carter is pushing too hard for liberalization, political liberalization, or democracy with the Shah of Iran and in Nicaragua.
Are you saying, though, James, that these – let's talk about the sort of three principal forward players here, Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Powell, for example, that they – have always been pushing from a second-tier position against presidents who have to deal with issues and are having problems with those. I mean, we have the contrast of Reagan saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, morality and foreign policy, and the role that Reagan just played in the Philippines that you described, where he's more interested in appeasing a non-democratic, anti-communist ally. Was there any kind of consistency in the Vulcans saying democracy is important? That, I mean, was there a point when that turned?
The Philippines produced a new kind of consistency. I think in Reagan's mind, the consistency was we're going to oppose, this is straight anti-communism, we're going to oppose the Soviets, and if we oppose the Soviets either on their own turf or in Eastern Europe on grounds that they're not democratic, fine. Marcos is an anti-communist, so we'll support him. If he's not democratic, we won't, we'll sort of forget it. Ultimately, others in the Reagan administration realized that was a glaring inconsistency, that just wouldn't hold, that they were being wildly inconsistent. And they finally won the debate.
There is a quote from Rise of the Vulcans. Paul Wolfowitz, speaking at that time, said, "You can't use democracy, as you appropriately should, in a battle with the Soviet Union, and then turn around and be completely hypocritical about it when it's on your side of the line." Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the Vulcans this hour with the author of a new book, Charting the History of Bush's War Cabinet. James Mann is my guest. We're going to Roxbury, Massachusetts, and Siddiqui's joining us. Siddiqui, thanks for calling.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, what I was calling for is I hear a certain amount of fragmentation in terms of the appearance that things kind of fell into place, you know, kind of abstractly, when the reality is that there has been a calculated plan starting with Kissinger and the Trilateral Commission in the 70s around the issue of world domination. And what happened was that you had Wolfowitz, Pearl, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and whomever, who actually picked up the ball, if you will, and came up with the concept of the new 21st Century America Project, wherein in 1998, 18 people signed a letter where they went to Clinton and said, look, you need to take out Iraq to establish it as a base of operations in the Mideast, not only in terms of oil and strategic reasons, but also economically, and then to move from that point to Asia to confront North Korea and ultimately the big bear, China, who they really fear. So it really amazes me that no one talks about the new 21st Century America Project, because it's actually has a website, and they blatantly talk about what this scheme is in terms of world domination for this country. So the Iraq War was that opening that they were looking for to establish that base of operations.
James, you do write about the project for a new American century in your book.
I do, and in talking around the country about the book, it's not as though people don't talk about the Project for a New American Century. In fact, people talk about it a lot. In my view, they tend to exaggerate its importance. Look, let me point out some of the contradictions in the question. The idea that this started with Henry Kissinger, that there was some plot that started with Henry Kissinger and the Trilateral Commission, well, as I just said, most of these people, the Vulcans, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, started their careers in opposition to Henry Kissinger, one. Two, the Trilateral Commission has nothing to do with the Project for a New American Century, and the policies they recommend, that the two organizations recommend, are completely different.
Striking thing is that as little as, what, 3-4 years ago, this gang was backing John McCain. They weren't even with George Bush in the early days of the president's campaign. That's right, and there's tension about that.
And one other thing, you know, if the Project for a New American Century, this is the kernel of truth in all this. They were enormously influential on Iraq policy. I would point out that if the Project for a New American Century were running the Bush administration's policies, we would see considerably different policies towards China, mm-hmm. Taiwan, North Korea, Russia, probably Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan than, in fact, we see today. Because on some issues, that project is influential, and on many others, it's not.
Although if we do go back into the 1970s, the one of this gang of Vulcans, Paul Wolfowitz, was writing specifically about Iraq at that time. I think you refer to him as something of an advanced scout for the neoconservatives, while others were still preoccupied with the Soviet Union.
Right. That's exactly right. In the 1970s, in the Pentagon, actually in President Carter's Pentagon, because he served there under the Democrats. The Pentagon was looking at when American military force might need to be used around the world. And one question was, well, what about the Persian Gulf and the oil fields of the Persian Gulf? And the first thing that the Pentagon did was I think, what you would expect the Pentagon would have done in the Cold War. They took a look at what would happen if the Soviet Union started moving its military forces towards the oil fields of the Persian Gulf. That wasn't, you know, in looking at that and getting this study, I wasn't surprised. But then Wolfowitz, who was in charge, took it the next step. He said, well, if we're worried about protecting the oil fields of the Persian Gulf, then what about Iraq? What if there's an Iraqi invasion of Kuwait or Saudi Arabia? And this was an extremely touchy thing to raise at the time. The defense secretary said, look, we really shouldn't be raising this issue. But it showed to me the ways in which Wolfowitz was kind of led the way in different kinds of thinking. It also gives you a certain perspective back. Wolfowitz, like others in the administration now, tends to focus on the abuses by Saddam Hussein as the prime motivating factor in intervention in Iraq. But his first interest back in the 1970s had to do with oil.
And just a little bit earlier this morning on NPR's Morning Edition, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz was talking about the connection between Iraq and September 11th and why he sees that as something which did in fact change on September 11th.
It's exactly the kind of thing where if something had happened that was clearly tied to Iraq, people would have said, why didn't you connect the dots? I thought the lesson of September 11th is you can't wait for 100% proof in this era.
Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. So to what extent then, James, and we'll have to be quick on this one because I do want to get to our callers, but to what extent then did September 11th change the ideas and the attitudes? I mean, it's not right, as some people have suggested, to say everything changed on September 11th, is it?
No, that's their point of view. That's what they generally try to say. I have a chapter in the book. It's actually a quote from Richard Armitage: "History starts today."
Right.
But I think you can't really look at what happened at September 11th without looking back at some of the other history, including Iraq.
Let's go to Northampton, Massachusetts, and Jake's joining us on the line. Jake, thanks for calling.
Good morning, Dick. Good morning, James. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have just two quick questions. As a three-time decorated vet, served almost 25 years ago, I want to ask James if you believe that the real power behind the Bush administration is Cheney, because I tend to think that because of his tenure with Reagan when I served in the military. And I'm just curious if you have an explanation to try to help a veteran out here, why President-elect Bush has not attended one memorial or funeral for over 560 people killed, soldiers killed in Iraq.
Two questions. Let's take the first one. And James, you do write about just how much power Cheney has in this White House.
Yeah, Cheney, I call him the most powerful vice president in history. That's not just his personal qualities or his views. At the beginning of the administration, he actually took care to put together and get the right to appoint his own staff. He has a whole foreign policy staff of his own. In the past, past vice presidents might have one guy, a chief of staff or something, to deal with foreign policy. He's got a whole staff, a whole bureaucracy to assist him, and they're quite powerful. Secondly, his
well, he appointed himself as well. That's not insignificant.
That's right. Secondly, you know, I think his power is not as great now, and this is a relative statement, as it was in the first year of the administration, when the administration first took office. I mean, he's the experienced hand, with a extremely close ally, for whom he's worked and with whom he's worked for 30 years at the Defense Department. That too gave him enormous influence. And he had other people throughout the government who had worked for him and under him, particularly in the Pentagon in the first Bush administration.
Well, I think a lot of people, though, think of Cheney as a pragmatist rather than an ideologue. But you go so far in the book, James, as to say that the war in Iraq is, in effect, Dick Cheney's war.
You know, he's pragmatic in the sense that he doesn't himself lay out a vision. He tends to leave that to others, notably at various points, Paul Wolfowitz. So, and when he talks in public, he's very, very, he talks in terms of pragmatism. But that doesn't mean doesn't have an ideology. In fact, he's a deeply conservative guy. I tell the story in the book of how when he's in Congress in the 1980s, at one point, one day the Washington Post describes him as a moderate congressman, and he comes out to his press secretary and says, "Will you call the Washington Post and tell them I'm not a moderate, that I'm a conservative? Don't they look at my voting record?"
And just
the caller's other question, yeah. I really can't answer as to why President Bush and the Memorial Services, again, the book is about his foreign policy team, and I can't answer that question.
But do you see Bush as sort of a manager of this group, letting them basically steer foreign policy while he just manages the White House? Is that reasonable?
He is the final decision maker. I don't mean to suggest otherwise.
Right.
You know, the buck stops with him. But he gets his options, his ideas, and often his information from the people around him, from the Vulcans.
All right, and Connection listeners, we are talking about the Vulcans this hour. Just exactly what is the power of the war cabinet of George W. Bush? We're talking about Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, and Richard Armitage. They are the ones singled out by James Mann in his new book, Where Do Their Ideas Come From? And What Are the Consequences for the Country? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour is James Mann. His previous books take a look at the way that the United States intersects with China. Books like Beijing Jeep and About Face, A History of America's Curious Relationship with China from Nixon to Clinton. His latest book is called Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. That's the subject of our conversation. This hour we're going to go to Alden, New York, and Carl's joining us from there. Carl, thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. I've heard from some political pundits lately the idea that there is a perception that's shared not only at higher levels, governmental levels, but among the common people that America has at its use or for its use the idea of exceptionalism. And this idea of exceptionalism I sort of equate with in my own perspective, chauvinism. I'm wondering if there is a way to look at our diplomatic history and really find a defining, a defining moment where we take this view of ourselves as a people and project it as a diplomatic tool. I think of the Monroe Doctrine as maybe being an initiating point. Thank you.
All right, great question, Carl.
Yeah, that's a perceptive question. Despite all the many differences among the members of the Bush team, I try to step back and say, what are the at least general underlying beliefs that they share in common? And one of them is that all believe that America is a force for good in the world. That's something that Colin Powell shares with Donald Rumsfeld, for example. And that's another way of the phrase American exceptionalism is another way of saying that. It's Ronald Reagan's idea that America is a city on a hill. I think that the end of the Cold War helped foster this idea that America should spread its ideas around the world. But as the caller says, this has very deep roots in American history.
And in modern history, James, would you go back to the last year of the Reagan administration when Wolfowitz was asked to redraft U.S. defense policy and say that was a, you know, in many ways the time when the idea of America's a force for good, the optimism of about America's capabilities, the power of the military, that those started to come together in the way the Vulcans hold it now?
Yeah, let me correct one detail. In the last year of the first Bush administration.
Oh yeah, you're right. Thanks.
Paul Wolfowitz, who was then an Undersecretary of Defense, was asked his staff was asked to put together a new document that would explain America's new defense strategy after the end of the Cold War. Everybody believes that this document, which leaked to the press, was written by Wolfowitz. In fact, in my own research and interviews with several of the participants, I really found that Cheney was the main sponsor of this. It was done by Wolfowitz's staff, but that was done by someone under him. It's now the American ambassador to Afghanistan named Zalmay Khalilzad. Actually, Wolfowitz never even saw it before it leaked to the press. But then it was rewritten. And to make it more careful, it was rewritten by Wolfowitz's own top aide, Scooter Libby, who's now Vice President Cheney's chief of staff. So several people in the current administration have ties to this document. And what this document said was that the United States should preserve its dominant role in the world. The phrase, the key euphemism, was that America should preserve its strategic depth.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, what is the Vulcan vision, and do you agree with it? We'd like to have you join us. It's interesting to go back to that moment, James, because in the early 90s, Powell and Cheney are working very, very close. And in fact, one of the things that I learned by reading the book was that Powell may well not be the sort of dovish character that he is made out to be in this particular administration.
That's right. In this administration, under some circumstances, Powell is quite dovish on the use of force and so on. But if you look at his whole career, there are times when he's been quite hawkish. And as you say, in the first Bush administration, Powell was appointed chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And his predecessor had not wanted to go ahead with a military intervention in Panama, and Powell was willing to do it and led the way on it. Then he stood by and worked with Cheney during the Gulf War, and the two worked closely together, were seen as partners, and yet I describe in the book the tensions between them, and the mm-hmm. tensions were over the relative role of the military versus civilian leadership, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the defense secretary. And those created a degree of distance and mistrust which lingered over into this administration.
Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina now. Alex is joining us on the phone. Alex, thanks for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Mann, nice to get you on the line here. I heard a lot about this book. I think you were on C-SPAN last week in the same book. It sounds like a fascinating compilation of interviews. Was that you on C-SPAN?
I don't believe I was on C-SPAN.
He's been a lot of places.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it. It sounds like a great compilation of history. And I'd also like to plug the NPR website because you have a lot of great streaming stuff. So a lot of these programs can be listened to in an archive form.
What's your question, Alex?
My question is this. With the Vulcans, and the only thing that these guys and women seem to have in common is the Pentagon background. And kind of in line with the question from Massachusetts a couple of calls ago, I'm wondering about a hidden agenda, and I believe it might be simply in that the military-industrial complex, so to speak, is benefiting with the ties of the president and whatnot with the contractors and the Carlyle Group and Halliburton's contracts in Iraq, as well as the campaign contributions that are going on here. And I'm wondering if the foreign policy is not really being dictated by corporate America kind of indirectly through campaign contributions. If you look at yesterday or 2 days ago, GE is one of the largest campaign contributors. They purchased a company that makes airport security for bomb scanning stuff. That same day after the purchase was announced, the government announced that they're giving GE a contract for these scanners, $100 million.
James, did you get into this kind of connection between the business world and the people who call themselves the Vulcans?
Let me give you my perspective on that. The caller is right about the importance of defense industries or the military-industrial complex. It's something going back to Eisenhower's warning. I don't find that it's a distinctive or distinguishing characteristic of this group. In fact, these guys tend to be interested in straight military power rather than private profit. And their ties to the defense industries are not unusual. Certainly Cheney has ties to Halliburton in his last years, although he spent most of his time in government. If you look at President Clinton's Defense Department, Defense Secretary William Perry came right out of defense industries. I don't find that the background and the ties of this group to defense industries are among their distinguishing characteristics.
But it's interesting, though, the point that Alex made about where foreign policy is coming from, because in that balance that always exists between the Pentagon and the State Department, I think it could be pretty easily argued that since September 11th, most of America's foreign policy has come from the building with five sides, no?
Yes, I agree with that.
And is that a worrisome thing? Is that something that we've seen in the past? Is that simply a reacting to events, the war on terror and so on?
It is a worrisome thing. It's more than in the past. And again, the contrast that I try to make in the book between this group and the Dean Acheson group called the Wise Men after World War II, who spent an awful lot of time on building new institutions, creating a different group of institutions for a new era. I haven't seen that as much from this group. The emphasis has been far more on military power. I agree with that critique.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm wondering, James, if we see the flaws in the Vulcans' grand plans in the smaller problems that they are asked to deal with. If we look at what's going on in Haiti right now, for example, is that where the idea of or the sort of bigger ideas of America as a force for good in the world and reluctance to, you know, have these accommodations, the UN connections, is that where these guys get themselves in trouble?
I think what we see in Haiti, we're right back to some of the dividing lines between the outgoing Clinton administration and the incoming second Bush administration. Haiti was one of the examples they used of problems that the United States, that they'd rather not deal with. They'd rather deal with major powers, China, Russia, India, or the Middle East, and that in some way things like Haiti or Sierra Leone were something that just someone else should take care of, but should not be a dominant factor in American foreign policy. And where they were during the campaign is sort of where they are now on this. They tried not to. There was reluctance to go to deal with Sierra Leone. They were reluctant on Haiti again.
And the same, I suppose, with the Mideast, with the Arab-Israeli conflict. Their policy is more a, we don't want to do what Clinton did, but we don't really know what we want to do. Is that reasonable?
Well, that one is a little more complicated. You get divisions in the administration all through 2002. You really get two schools of thought on what was the relationship between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and Iraq. And you get it in two different ways. One school said, we can't deal with Iraq until we make some headway on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict,
right.
Because we will have more support both within the Middle East and from our allies. The other school said, we should deal with Iraq first because it will help us deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It will in some way weaken either Yasser Arafat or his supporters, as happened after the first Gulf War. And obviously the second school won that debate within the administration. They went ahead with the war in Iraq, and so far we haven't seen any great headway on the Middle East.
You wrap up the book by talking about and evaluating the invasion of Iraq. Do you see it as perhaps the almost perfect expression of all the ideals of the Vulcans coming together?
Yeah, I do see it as combining several different elements of the Vulcans' thoughts, certainly the belief in military power, the reluctance to engage in accommodations, the belief that America should spread its values around the world. And then the fourth thing, which we haven't talked about, which is just this has just a straightforward belief in how much power America has. I point out throughout the book at several points in the 70s and 80s, there were others who argued, you know, we better be careful because the United States is not as powerful as it thinks. And the Vulcans were the group of people who argued, no, actually, the United States has more power. We're talking now about both military and economic power than people think.
James, good of you to join us for the program.
Thank you very much, Richard.
James Mann is author of Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. Our program is produced by Nancy Cohen, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations.